Hello listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult Vault. For this instalment, I have something a little different for you all. A cult movement that's had hardly any literature or infamy within the world of sects. This movement was led by Dr. Betty Eisner. Eisner created her own community, a community that she controlled. From the big things, all the way down to the very small things. She did this through manipulation and a position of power. This came from her supposed rehabilitation through drug therapy. Today, I have a very special guest. Her name is Tori, and she has agreed to come on and interview with me and tell her story of growing up inside Dr. Eisner's community. I have to apologise in advance for the quality of this audio. I'm not recording in the place that I usually do, so it's probably going to sound a bit more disruptive than it usually does. So I really do apologise for this in advance. There really isn't much in terms of research on cults about Dr. Betty Eisner. When you load up her Wikipedia page, it says this. Early life and education. Eisner grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, where she graduated from the Sunset Hill School in 1933. She earned her undergraduate degree in political science from Stanford University in 1937. During World War II, she served as a Red Cross volunteer. After the war, she travelled across Europe, an experience she documented in a series of letters to the Los Angeles Times. After returning to the US, she earned a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of California, Los Angeles. Eisner conducted psychotherapy research, first with Sidney Cohen at the Neuropsychiatric Hospital Veterans Administration Center in Los Angeles, and later, from her private practice in Los Angeles. Eisner authored a book, The Unused Potential of Marriage and Sex, which was published in 1970. She also helped found the School of Learning, which taught English in Mexico. In the 1990s, she maintained a private practice in Santa Monica, California, occasionally publishing articles on psychotherapy and serving on the board of advisors for the Albert Hofmann Foundation. In 2002, Eisner wrote an unpublished autobiographical account of her career entitled Remembrances of LSD Therapy Past. Eisner's accomplishments are considerable, even if one does not consider how few independent women scientists there were in the 1950s and 60s. She conducted early research into the use of LSD to treat alcoholism and maintained an active interest in hallucinogens throughout her career. Along with Sidney Cohen, Eisner appears to have originated the practice of using simultaneous male and female therapists or researchers during human hallucinogen administration. Eisner was a therapist for Bill Wilson, co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, when he tried LSD. In addition to using hallucinogens, like LSD and mescaline, in psychedelic therapy, Eisner also gave stimulants, such as the inhaled gas mixture Carbogen, to her patients. However, Eisner's interest in finding new tools for psychotherapy was not limited to drugs. Eisner was particularly focused on extra-pharmacological variables that she felt influenced outcome of psychotherapeutic sessions. She considered the specific individuals present as an important variable in therapeutic outcome and sometimes conducted sessions in group settings. Some of these group sessions included encounter group style expression and bodywork. Eisner also described the psychotherapeutic importance of a variable she called matrix. This term encompassed the everyday living space and larger social context in which the patient lived and returned to between sessions. Betty Eisner's publications and personal correspondence are archived in Stanford University. I also found it extremely interesting that the community Eisner ran was located in Santa Monica, close to where Synanon and their LSD therapy had also been operating at exactly the same time. If you don't know about Synanon, you should quickly go back and have a listen to the episode that I covered a few weeks back, which sheds a lot of light on Santa Monica during this time and the pioneers of LSD research. Upon looking into Betty Eisner a bit closer, it came to my attention that when she pioneered her LSD research, she did it with none other than Dr. Keith Dittman. Keith Dittman was the person who approached Alcoholics Anonymous asking for participants for his LSD drug trials and research. Charles E. Dederick, the leader of Synanon, was a participant in these early experiments and had his, quote, awakening during his LSD experience under Dittman's watch. He then took this and applied it to Synanon later on. So would you believe it? They really are linked. Dr. Betty Eisner, PhD, wrote a book titled Remembrances of LSD Therapy Past. She released this in 2002. The foreword reads, "This book consists of my recollections, correspondence to and from me about work with psychedelics and reports about drug sessions. Its purpose is to not only document work that I and others did, but to also make a case for the therapeutic potential, given the proper circumstances, of the drugs discussed. For further information about my work, I have donated my files to Stanford. Although the book contains biographical material, it is not complete. Names of researchers or people known to have used the drug are included, as are the names of my husband, Will, his sister, Helen, his brother and sister-in-law, Bob and V, my brother, Jack, and our children, Malia and DB. Other names have been replaced by one or two letters. I would like to thank all the people who made my work possible, and also thank my children, Dr. David Eisner and Dr. Malia Grover Mackay, for their help with this book." The chapters within this are as follows. Initiation into Infinity. The Parameters of Infinity. Chapter 3, Our Research. Chapter 4, More Investigation of Parameters. Exploring the Mind Through Space, The Trip to Europe. A New Environment, New Direction. The Researchers Get Together, International Conferences. Chapter 8, The Light of LSD Starts to Go Out. Chapter 9, One Session After Another. Chapter 10, More Sessions. To understand how Betty viewed the work she was doing and the positive effects of LSD therapy, I wanted to read you a short segment from Chapter 3, Our Research, before jumping into Tori's cult account. The short segment reads, "Probably our most dramatic patient was an alcoholic who had been hospitalized 23 times for bouts of drunkenness during which he usually became violent. JD had 7 LSD sessions with discussions in between when he requested them. He improved to the point of being discharged from the hospital and has never been re-hospitalized, some 35 years later, although he did drink again. His weekly productions in the arts clinic are a fascinating record of the drama of his recovery, although they do not picture the event which made his recovery possible. The abreaction of an incident where he had been captured by the Germans in World War II and had had to kill 2 Germans in order to escape and return through enemy lines to his own Air Force unit. Another interesting case was a hospitalized patient who was obviously on the verge of a psychotic episode. I'm afraid we'll blow him into a paranoid schizophrenic psychosis with LSD, I told the ward doctor. Well, he's going to have a paranoid breakdown anyway, if we don't do something, the doctor replied. And there's nothing lost if we try. So, with Sid's approval, we gave the patient a series of LSD sessions of gradually increasing the dosage and walked him past his psychosis so that he was able to be discharged the following month. Again, we have a record of his progress in the pastel drawings he did each week. With respect to approval, Sid and I had decided that no subject matter would be approved for the study unless interviewed by both of us. And we agreed that the person was appropriate for the study. The agreement was breached twice, once when we accepted a patient by phone without having interviewed him, and Sid's solo approval of a patient who later, after I had gone into private practice, broke into my office back door and knocked me out of my chair from behind. This was a schizoid patient who was almost impossible to tolerate until he was under LSD, and then he could be related to. He had been unable to get a job or maintain a relationship, but after 16 LSD sessions, he was able to do both. However, evidently, we didn't drain the reservoir of his hostility enough during his sessions. Incidentally, it was interesting to note how LSD lowered an individual's barriers enough to make the person possible to relate to, no matter how unpleasant or hostile before. All patients were lovable once the LSD was working strongly. For anyone interested in learning more about this, I will provide a link to the book on my show notes. But without further ado, here is my interview with Tori. So hello, listeners. I'm really excited to be able to bring you an interview today with a lovely lady called Tori, who has agreed to tell us her story of her time in a cult. So hello, Tori, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Casey. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate this.
Thank you so much for coming to chat with me today. I'm really looking forward to be able to ask you these questions and giving our listeners a little bit of insight into something I don't think we've heard about before. So thank you very much, Tori. Would you like to start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself or your background?
Well, I'm in my 50s now. I left the cult when I was, well, I used college as an excuse to escape from the cult. So I grew up in California, and the cult was in Santa Monica, California. So when I was looking at colleges, I found the college that was furthest away. I really wanted to go to Colorado, but I kind of felt like, oh, that's too close. They expect me to be coming home. So I went to New York. I went to school in New York, and that was kind of like how I got away from it all. So I lived in New York for like 6 years. I don't know why, but then I came back to California. So I have been living in California since 89, I suppose. And I ended up in a career. I've been in my career for 30 years now. I'm a juvenile probation officer.
Wow.
And I absolutely love it. And I feel very grateful for my background in helping me deal with the types of kids that I deal with and having more empathy for them. And so that's kind of a rough background. I've never been married, no children. I attribute that, well, I don't have children because I didn't want to screw them up. And I am not married because seems like I always thought I picked the wrong people, but then I reflected back and I said, I'm the common denominator. So a year and a half ago is when I really got into therapy and to try and figure that out. And they're the ones that told me I had PTSD and trauma from being in the cult. So this past year has been a huge healing process for me. So there you go. That's a little bit of my background.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. It's funny that you say you didn't want children because you didn't want to mess them up, but actually you're working with young adults to make sure you keep them on the right path.
Right. Well, maybe because I feel like I wasn't heard or seen as a kid. So I feel like these kids don't feel so heard or seen. So that's always been my, that's what I wanted to do. My own child, I don't, you know.
We're here to talk today about your childhood experience. And it does involve you being born into a cult. So it's my understanding that you didn't know anything different whilst you were a child.
No. This was the... Well, to clarify that, the first, yes, my parents were already with this cult leader before I was born.
Right. Okay. Do you know how they became involved at all?
She was a therapist, and they were seeking out therapy.
Right.
Because my father, from my understanding, my father was very abusive to my mother.
Right.
And so that's why they got into therapy.
Okay.
And she was a new therapist. She had just graduated from UCLA. I'm pretty sure it's
where. Okay. And this is the leader of the movement.
Yes.
Okay. And so was the nature of the cult itself, was it a therapeutic based movement?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Can you tell us a little bit more sort of about who the leader was and how the cult advertised itself to the outside world?
Okay, so it's interesting because I feel like our cult is a bit different, but I'm sure everybody feels that way about their particular cult and that they have these unique little elements in it. Betty Eisner, who's the cult leader, she had she was at UCLA, and this is back in the late 50s, early 60s, and they were introducing LSD as a form of therapy. So she was on the cutting edge of utilizing and experimenting with LSD for therapeutic purposes. And there's a long history about what happened with the LSD, and I'm not going to get into that because I personally don't, I didn't experience LSD myself. But then LSD became illegal, so then she moved to other drugs to help people deal with their, personal demons, you know, and so that they could reach their highest potential. And that was everybody's purpose when they got into the cult. Now, how it was advertised, it wasn't, to my knowledge. I mean, I would imagine it was word of mouth. We were rather small. It was probably, I'm guessing at its height, it was 60 or 70 people. No, 70 is too much. I would say 50 to 60 is probably at it.
And were you all living together as one sort of family or collective?
So good question. We started off in my early years, we were all lived with our particular families, our birth families.
Right. Okay.
When I was six, it seems like that's when things started dividing up.
Okay.
So that would have been, in the early 60s, mid 60s. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then communes, we started developing communes.
Right.
And so different people own these different houses all throughout, mostly throughout Santa Monica, but that general area, kind of somewhere in, that geographical area, I'm just going to say. And then the houses were made up of different people. It seems like Betty would orchestrate who was living at which house. And so for myself, I think I was in like seven houses.
Oh my goodness.
By the time I was 12.
Oh wow, so lots of moving about.
It was a lot of moving about, a lot of different schools. And each house, the complicated thing for me was each house you have different, now you're all under the umbrella of the cult, of Betty's say-so, right? Because she led everything. She was in charge of everything. But you have different personalities in each house. And so you, as a little kid, you have to figure out.
Yeah, of course.
How to manage all these different people and their personalities and their expectations.
Right. So you've lived with your birth family until a certain age, and then you've moved from house to house under Betty's instruction. Who lives in what house is all determined by her.
Right.
And then how many other family members, birth family members, did you have within this movement, and did you ever get a chance to see them at all?
Well, I'm the youngest of four.
Okay.
And love my siblings because I was six. So I looked up to each of them, right? They were like my heroes. And then all of a sudden we're all spread apart. And that was horrible for me. I mean, it was just like heart-wrenching. I lost my parents and my siblings. There was, how many other families? Feel like there were four other families that had children.
Okay.
At that time. And some of the siblings actually got to stay together. Some of the siblings didn't. Like in my family, we were separated. My two sisters actually got to go to a really nice house with a really nice couple initially. So that was kind of, they had a fun time, actually. Did we get to see each other? Yes. We would have group parties. We would have, the kids got to attend group parties, never the group meetings.
Right.
Because we were too young. We had our own little group meeting. And
okay.
So at those group meetings, we did see our parents, but we were not allowed to engage with our parents.
Oh, so they happened sort of in conjunction with each other whilst the adults were meeting, the children would have sort of their own time to...
No, these group parties actually were a real party.
Okay.
And, but when the kids came and you saw your parents and you get all excited because you haven't seen them for a while.
Of course.
And you want to go run up and like hug them and just be like, oh my God, mommy, mommy, right? You couldn't do that because you had an interlock with them.
Right.
And so they wanted to separate that connection.
Wow. Did you ever speak to your parents at any point about all of this and how it made them feel?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
They've passed on now, but I did. And my father said that he doesn't regret it. He said okay. He didn't regret it at all because it helped him so much. He was sorry that I had to live in a particular house with a particular woman who was just evil. But other than that, no, my father wasn't sorry. And my mother said that she stayed with it because she wanted us to have a father.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Betty in particular, so she makes the decisions on everything you mentioned before.
Right.
How did she, what was her leadership approach? What type of lady did she come across as? Was she approachable? Did you ever get time one-to-one with her?
Yes, because we had to see her every once in a while as a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
You felt as though, well, she was charismatic.
Okay.
You know? So you felt as though she really cared about you. She cared about you, but your parents didn't really care about you. Your parents were incapable of loving you.
Okay. And this is what
there.
Betty would say?
Yes. And
okay.
She was there to fill that gap. Well, in that she was charismatic and you felt like your parents didn't love you, you mm-hmm. really looked to her for some comfort.
Right.
Now, she wasn't particularly comforting. I think you kind of got used to nobody really loved you. You just felt like hopefully Betty was protecting you and she was putting your best interests at heart. And so you were everybody was constantly working on their anger. Who knew that a child could be so angry?
Okay. And is this something that she would point out that all the children had to be working on, or was it true that all the children were angry?
No, we weren't angry.
Right.
But it became part of our lifestyle. Like every day, we had to run to get rid of our hostility.
Mm-hmm.
We punched a bag to get rid of our hostility. And we had to do this thing called blasting to get rid of our hostility. And blasting is you would basically, we put a washcloth in our mouth to muffle the sound. And you would hold somebody's shoulders. You put your hands on their shoulders and you look them in the eye and you just growl at them. And you just go,
okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you use these types of words, is this inside language that was unique to your community?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So we were always projecting on each other. Our hostility would give somebody stuff. And they would have like a sore back because of your stuff.
Right.
You know, which your anger would permeate the energy of the room.
Right.
And
I think we spoke a little bit about how people within the community were promoted to keep an eye on each other and snitch on each other.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was every man for themselves.
So there was no level of trust amongst anybody?
Uh-huh. No, because every week at the group meetings, you had to sit around in a circle mm-hmm. and you had to basically tell on yourself for what happened that week. You would tell, like if you were in school, you would say, these are the grades that I got. This is what I did wrong. I forgot this. I forgot to do that. And all of that was lying because you don't ever really forget. So you're punished for lying, which is you get paddled. And then you have to do a job to make up for it, which is like scrubbing floors and stuff like that.
Okay. And if you didn't if you didn't snitch on yourself, is there the potential that somebody else will tell the group what you did? Is the punishment more severe if you don't own up to it yourself? Right. Yes. Okay. Because I mean, this sounds exactly like the Synanon and CDU coverage that I did. It sounds so similar, especially because Synanon was actually based in Santa Monica as well. And they used to sit around in circles and scream in each other's faces. And they use LSD as therapeutic hallucinogen. So it's just really eerie how similar.
My father went to Synanon.
Oh, he did?
He was kicked out of our group. And for one of his punishments, he had to go to Synanon for, I think, one of those weekend retreats.
My goodness. For the trip, the LSD?
Probably,
there was like a 48-hour workshop called The Trip where they would deprive the participants of sleep, and everybody would take LSD and they would bring all the participants up to a high and then bring them all down collectively to a low. And then at the end of it, they walked out into a hall with like marching band music and everybody praising them and hugging them, and everybody would embrace like it was the most magnificent experience they'd ever had.
Right.
So I can't believe how similar this is. And you said that some of the children actually got sent to Synanon if they misbehaved as well.
Just my father. Other adults, not as kids. I never went to Synanon, but I knew about Synanon. And the head shaving in Synanon, Betty brought that into, our group, only three of us had our head shaves. Me, my brother, and my older sister. I don't know why anyone else didn't have their head shaved. And that was for lying. And my sister was her senior year of high school, so she went to her prom bald. My brother was a ninth grader in junior high, and I was in the seventh grade in junior high.
Were these typical punishments, head shaving and paddling?
Paddling, definitely. Everybody got paddled.
Okay.
And we would paddle adults as kids. There would be a long line if an adult was getting paddled or whoever. There'd be a long line of us at a group meeting, and we'd take our turns and tell that person, each person, like 20 people would say, I'm paddling you for line. And then you had to paddle them three times.
Okay. And did Betty ever join in with any of these sessions?
She was at the sessions. I don't remember her ever doling out any of the punishments.
So if she is encouraging different types of punishments and making sure that all of these are being carried out, was there any sort of reward system in place for people that, you know, sort of fell in line, abided by the rules?
So the reward would be, you just kind of felt like you were like, you know, you were in the inner circle and everybody would talk to you, because if you were in the doghouse, as we would call it, then you get shunned and people don't talk to you, people don't hug you, which was a big thing for us. Everybody was hugging all the time. So you were an outcast. And sometimes you actually got kicked out of the group and you weren't allowed to participate. And then until you accomplished everything that Betty had laid out for you to accomplish.
Do you mean participate as in participate in the community as a whole or in particular activities?
As a whole. Like you couldn't attend the group meetings. You couldn't attend the social functions. Mm-hmm. We got together Sunday. We had Sunday meals together. All the groups would. Everybody would come together to one house and have a Sunday meal. There was a Tuesday group, a Wednesday night taco salad night at Betty's house. To this day, I don't eat taco salad, by the way. And then Thursday night would be another group. And I think the two groups were, one was with the younger people and one was with the older adults. And then every Friday we had a TGIF at another house, which was just socializing and everybody coming together. So our time was always orchestrated, and we were always so insular that we didn't really socialize with people outside of the group. So we were allowed to, but you're just so weird. Like, it was uncomfortable too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It just sounds like there was no time for any of that as well.
Yeah.
So I've also made a point here that sometimes frequent drug use could be offered as a reward if you stayed in favor.
The adults they liked their drug sessions.
Mm-hmm.
So if they were doing well, then they would get a drug session.
Okay.
If you were really bad, then you didn't get a drug session. So yes, it was kind of used as a reward. Did I say what the drugs were at that point? Because it wasn't LSD anymore.
I think you did mention it in a previous message. I think one of them was Ritalin.
Yeah, it was Ritalin and gas or ketamine.
Right, okay. And do you know how the drug sessions worked, what they looked like?
Well, I was in one.
Okay.
When I was 12. So what it looked like for me was, there were a bunch of people at Betty's house. We're in her living room. Classical music is playing. You lay down on the floor. There were a bunch of adults sitting around me. My sister was having her drug session at the same time. Same thing for her, a bunch of adults sitting around her. I was injected with Ritalin. And I was, quite honestly, I was terrified because I've never had a drug before. I didn't know what was going to happen, and I didn't trust these people.
Mm-hmm.
And during the session, you are supposed to come up with feelings.
Right.
And express your feelings and say what's going on and what do you feel and what do you see. And Betty was a big believer in past lives, so you would like share if there was a past life. And all I remember about my session is I just copied everything my sister said, I said, my older sister. And that way I wouldn't get in trouble for doing it wrong. And Betty's reaction was amazing. Betty's reaction was like, whoa, look at this interlock between the two of them. This is fascinating. And I'm thinking to myself, you're so stupid. You didn't even know. I'm just like faking all this.
Yeah, I wonder if she knew and she realized how obvious it seemed. So she needed to make it sound like it was more like a prophecy than it was. That must be, I can't imagine how terrifying it is at 12 years old to have an injection of any kind, let alone have the pressure of a whole group of adults sitting around you and not knowing what the effects of this substance are going to be. Do you remember how it made you feel in any way?
No, I don't actually. I didn't, because I was aware enough to just copy my sister. Mm-hmm. But then she gave me gas afterwards, and that was terrifying because that I really got a high from, and I'd never been high, and I did not like it at all. And I said, she had an eye mask on me, so I couldn't see. And I said, I really don't like the eye mask. I feel like I just want to break away because people were holding me down.
Oh, wow.
And she goes, no, you can't break away. And I was just like, just Lord, let this end. I had been punished so much by that point. I just learned to just like disassociate and just like, at some point, this has got to end.
I remember us speaking as well about punishments that involved a clock and being tied to a bed.
Oh my God. Okay, the clock one is kind of funny. This poor guy, he was in college. I was very young at the time, probably elementary school. He was in college and he was late to everything. So she made him wear a clock, a regular alarm clock, like a necklace around his neck. And he had to take the bus and he was going to college and he had to wear that clock everywhere he went. And the alarm would go off when he was supposed to be wherever he was supposed to be. Can you imagine?
Why would he? Do you think he took it off when he was not within eyesight, or because Bessie would find out?
Yeah, because you really believe this stuff. I'm sure he wouldn't have taken it off. And then the tying to the bed, that is that's heartbreaking to me that people would be tied to the bed for like 3 days at a time and they had to just lay in their mess and they would be you know, their ankles tied to the bottom bedpost and the wrist to the top bedpost. And when we were little, they tied my mother to her bed.
Oh, my goodness.
And this is when we all still lived together, the four, right. all my family. And some men came in, tied her up, and they said, now you might hear some noises coming from your mom's bedroom, but don't worry, she'll be fine and we'll be back tomorrow.
That is absolutely heartbreaking.
I can't even imagine my poor mother. Like
that is, and you said it was so that people could get rid of their anger.
Yeah.
What sort of infraction do you think would cause somebody to receive that punishment?
Lord only knows.
I can't. That must be. And then to be told that you have to go and live in a house and not be able to see your mom, you must have been worried about her all of the time.
Oh, I was just, I was homesick all the time. I cried all the time. I cried so much that they said, "Oh, you're going to act like a baby. We're going to treat you like a baby." And every day after school, I had to wear a diaper.
Oh, my and I goodness.
Would, nah, second or third grade.
That's absolutely monstrous.
It was, there was so much use of belittling people
mm-hmm.
and it's shaming, you know, and I think that that's a common thing throughout cults
mm-hmm.
is this shaming, and then so that you start losing your sense of self and you're wholly dependent on the cult leader. Yeah, and I think it's so important that people who have experienced cults that they get help for, because they were traumatized. There's so much trauma in these cults. It's
all of the interviews I've done so far, you're right when you say it seems to be a common thread, because the Pentecostals movement, I spoke to a couple of people from different denominations of Pentecostalism. Shame was rife within their movements. Sidhu, I spoke to a survivor a few weeks ago, and Michael was talking about how shame was used a lot of the time, along with manipulation about how would your parents feel, and then using information that you would say in truth-telling sessions against you later on, or, you know, or threatening to tell your parents, or actually telling your parents, these things that you would say in these sessions that weren't necessarily even the truth, just to get the spotlight off of you, to be left alone.
Exactly. That was the same for, in fact, I was talking to my sister the other day, and she said, you know, I always thought that we were brought up to tell the truth, but we weren't, because we had no idea how we felt, because if we didn't feel the way they determined that we should be feeling, then we were lying in what mm-hmm. we said. So you're better off just saying, yeah, I'm angry, I'm this, I'm, you know, okay, one time, I'm outing myself here. One time I was working at a movie theater and we got high at work, right? And my sisters all of a sudden showed up at work and I was terrified, like, oh my God, what have I done wrong? Because I didn't trust them
mm-hmm.
and I was high and I was afraid they were going to be able to tell because my eyes were bloodshot, right? So my sisters don't even know this. So I ran and hid, and I told my coworkers, don't tell them where I am. So they told them exactly where I was. So my sisters came up and they're like, what's up? And I actually told my sisters, I said, well, I was crying because I was upset with our mother. And I felt like she was really heavy. And I put the whole thing on my mother. Oh, that was great, because I made somebody else look bad. And they didn't have a clue.
Yeah, didn't doubt it for a second.
Right. And they just hugged me and they go, yeah, we understand. And my poor mom, you know, I just... But that type of behavior was accepted. Now, me getting
high. Do you often speak to your sisters about these experiences?
Yeah, we're all trying to work. Yeah, yeah.
All of you are working through it together at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's good.
I mean, we all do it differently, but I still adore my siblings. they are my rock.
It's really nice that you have the three of them to talk through these things with. I've often speak to people who Jehovah's Witnesses mostly who move away or defellowshipped from their right. respective religion, and their entire family have just cut them off. There's no contact right. at all. You know, the family members wouldn't dare speak to the defellowshipped family member, you know, for fear of repercussions on themselves. So it's obviously extremely traumatic and unfortunate that the four of you had to go through all of this. But to have the three of them to speak through about it, I think is something that not a lot of people actually, when they leave a cult, have. So that's...
Well, I didn't have that initially.
Okay.
Initially, I wrote Betty a letter and I said, I don't want to have anything to do with you. A friend of mine, her mom helped me write this letter.
Right.
To stand up for myself. And Betty told my mother that she'd gotten this horrible letter from me. I was just lost soul to give up on me. And, you know, I was just crazy. And yeah, when you leave on your own. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for us to come back together, you know, me and my siblings and
okay.
other people in the group. But yeah, they shun you in the beginning.
Did you all leave at different times, or did the movement itself just have a cutoff date?
We all left at different times and in different ways.
Okay. Okay.
My other sister, she wrote a letter and read it to the entire group and was devastated because nobody really responded. Nobody supported her.
Okay.
And her truth.
And when you were separated from your family and moved into different homes, the people whose houses you moved into, they weren't called parents, but they were known as authority figures?
Yes.
And you mentioned one particular woman before. I didn't know if you wanted to go back and touch on that at all.
She was horrible.
Was she like an evil stepmom?
She was a teacher, and she treated me like, well, she used to call me Cinderella.
Okay.
My life with her was absolute hell.
So yeah. not the princess side of Cinderella, the cooking and cleaning and...
Scrubbing floors.
Right.
I was constantly. I was constantly in trouble with her. I could do nothing right. She, I really struggled a lot with her. It was, and zero protection. I don't know why, but it's kind of left to the wolves with her.
Right. So there's nobody you can go and tell and sort of ask for support from? No. And when you were moved out of your home, do your parents get to stay together in a home, or are they separated too?
They're separated, brought back together again, separated at one point. They were together, and then my father had a mistress, and then she moved into that house, and everybody was kind of having sex, was part of the attraction, I think, for especially the men, because if they wanted to have sex with somebody, Betty would kind of coordinate it.
Okay, and so these weren't decisions that people made themselves. They was the mistress sort of assigned to your father, or did it just start up organically?
Yeah, my father really loved her.
Okay.
So that started up organically. However, he was still married to my mom.
Right.
And my mom, in that house, my mom was moved to the guest house in the back, and his mistress had, you know, the two of them shared a room.
Right.
That was when I was in high school, and I actually was living with them at that point.
And how was that? How was that for your, that must have been difficult for you and your mom.
Oh, I hated it. I hated my parents because I'd already been so abused by this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And now my parents, I'm in high school, and now you're going to tell me what to do? No, I don't think so.
Right.
I had zero respect for my parents. I hated my father for what he was doing to my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Then I asked to move to another house because I just hated it. And, you know, I did have a great year, though. I had one incredible year.
Okay, tell me about it. I want to hear the whole thing.
This year, my brother and I, we had just had our, both of us had had our head shaved. And we were just like the epitome of like, nobody wanted us anymore. They wanted to send me away to boarding school. And I think it would have ended up being one of those CEDU schools after hearing that.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, do you want to go to boarding school? And I really did. But I thought if I said yes, they wouldn't send me. So I said no. And they didn't end up sending me to boarding school. But my father's father had a construction company that was doing a huge project in Saudi Arabia. Right. So my father got kicked out of the group and my mother got sent with him so that they could work on their relationship in Saudi Arabia. It was like a punishment.
Okay.
Then my brother and I get our head shaved and it seems like people don't want us. They tell me to write a letter to my parents asking them if they will take me. I literally had no idea if they would say yes or no, because I really thought that they didn't love me.
Okay.
But they said yes. My brother and I ended up spending a year in Saudi Arabia, and it was just my brother and I and our parent and our mom and dad. And we were kids,
mm-hmm.
just kids for an entire year. Went to an international school in Saudi Arabia, and I loved it. It was so, like, there was no stress, there was no fear, there was, it was just normal. It was fantastic.
That's nice. That's lovely.
Yeah, it was.
So your mother moves into the back house, your father brings in his mistress. Is this common throughout other households in the community that people would get involved with other people?
Yes.
Okay. And were these decisions that or things that also happened organically, or was this something to do with Betty?
Betty organized a lot of the relationships, Daisy, no. So I guess some were organic, but I know that there was a lot of group sex going on.
Okay.
I know for myself, there was a guy that wanted to be with me. He wanted to sleep with me. And I said yes. I mean, I was asked. I have to mm-hmm. say that. And I said yes, only because I truly thought it was good for my growth.
Right.
Even though I had zero attraction to this guy, didn't want to sleep with him. It was so ingrained in us that you do these activities, especially if Betty thinks it's good for you, for your personal growth. Because if you say no, well, then that means that you have a block.
Okay.
And you are resisting your personal growth, and therefore you will not achieve your what is their word?
Full potential is something I often hear.
That's it.
Yeah, full potential is a seems to be another one of those coined phrases of the cults.
Yeah, that and was what we were always striving for. Full potential.
Full potential. And if people were married and it was suggested by Betty that they sleep with somebody else, did they would just do it?
Oh, yeah. I used to think, you know, like, whoever marries me is going to be so lucky because I won't care if they have an affair.
That's terrible, isn't it? That's not any way anybody should think about themselves.
Exactly. Yeah.
When people joined the communes, was there a cost to join or participate? Were you expected to work jobs or raise money?
No, we weren't. Not like I hear in other cults. No, okay. There was nothing like that. Everybody worked out and they worked in their field. I think Betty made her money from forcing people to have like a lot of therapy or drug sessions because they had to pay extra for the drug session.
Right.
So I think, and she had a huge, beautiful house in a very nice part of Santa Monica.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. Do you know roughly how much people were paying for these drug sessions?
I read that the drug sessions were like $250, and that was back in the 60s.
Yeah. That's probably a lot of money.
I don't know because my parents had to pay her. So I personally don't know.
And whilst you lived within the commune, were you expected to carry out chores, jobs, work on the land at all? Or was that all taken care of?
Okay, so imagine this. We lived in these big, beautiful mansions in the wealthier part of Santa Monica.
Okay.
So we looked like we really fit into society very nicely, mm-hmm. but there were these communes throughout Santa Monica. And the kids are the ones that kept the houses clean.
Right.
That was their job to do all the cleaning. The adults, no. They just did their job. They went to work.
Oh, they did.
And they
were
highly educated. I mean, and Betty really pushed education. Mm-hmm. So there were so many PhDs, MDs, a lot of physicists, engineers, just highly educated people.
It's funny because I think I speak about this a lot, but I think one of the biggest misconceptions with indoctrination into a cult is that people have to be maybe not as intelligent or not strong-willed, but actually when you dig into it and you read about the people that are indoctrinated into cults, it's actually the opposite of that. A lot of the time it's very, very highly educated, very intelligent people and very strong-willed people as well. Maybe it's there has to be some displeasure with life or work or something missing that would drive you to have to join a group.
I feel like the people that join these groups are seekers, and they believe that there's more to life than just your mundane going to work every day, mm-hmm. coming home and being with your family, and that they want to figure out like kind of like the meaning of life or
and usually the leader will promise you the answers to those questions.
Yeah.
Do you know how Betty would recruit new members into the fold? Was there any promotional material or was it just referrals for therapy?
It was referral for therapy.
Okay. And did she offer any kind of retreats or was it just the getting together sort of most days of the week?
Yeah, we just, every once in a while, I would say we went places. I mean, we vacationed together.
Oh, yes, summers. You had summers with your biological family.
Yeah, that was great. Well, I mean, everybody would go down to Mexico together, and all the kids would live in one house, and all the adults would be in another house down in this town in Mexico. And it was fabulous for me because I got to actually live in the same house with my siblings, and I just loved that.
What was the purpose for the trip for the trip down to Mexico?
Well, it's actually, this is a cool part of what I got, you know, we did do is we taught a school down in a little village outside of Puerto Vallarta. And so 5 days a week, we go into the village and we would teach the kids English and science.
Awesome.
And yeah, it was fantastic. That was fun. And then the Mexican kids would come back and live with us in these communes. And that was cool too, you know, living with these kids.
So like an exchange program.
Yeah.
I think when we spoke about you spending summer with your family, you mentioned an incident where you were locked in a car.
Well, I used to get in trouble a lot down in Mexico too. I don't know why I was always in trouble.
It's because you're so angry.
Yeah, I guess I have so much hostility, don't I? Yeah, I would get in trouble, and then everybody would be going to the beach. They'd tell me to stay in the car. They'd close all the doors, and they'd tell me to stay there. And it's hot in Mexico in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets really hot in the car with everything closed. And then, of course, I would get caught because I'd open up the door to get some fresh air before I fainted. And then they'd be like, you know, you lied, you opened the door, why'd you do that? And then they start yelling at me. I'm sure now they understand that you're not even supposed to do that for a dog. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely not. So it was also encouraged that you all keep a diary as well?
Yeah, yeah. We kept a diary.
Were these ever read, or was that something private that you could have for yourself?
No, they were read, and it was pretty much like the other cult you were talking about. They use that information against you.
Right.
So when you're writing, you pretty much write knowing that they're going to be reading it. So you pretty much, the more you put yourself down and you say, you know, I have all this anger, I lie, that's really good because you're being honest.
Okay. And they were read within the group meetings? Were they read aloud or by a certain group of people?
For me, it was I think it was just your authority figure would read it.
Right, okay, okay.
Punish you appropriately say whatever they, you know.
And you also mentioned that at one point, Betty would actually want so much control over people that she would order some people to go through other people's trash to spy on them.
Yeah.
Was this an escalation? Was this something that always happened?
I feel like that was towards the end. That was like, yeah, the escalation.
Okay. Okay. When you say end, you mean the point where you left?
It actually died down. She stopped it because she could see that she was losing control of everybody.
Okay.
30 years, it had been going on for 30 years.
Right. Okay.
So it made it about 30 years. She lost her license in the 70s, but she continued on. Yeah, she continued on into the 80s. She lost her license because one of her, one of the group members died during a drug session. And they did a 2-year investigation into it.
Okay.
And found that she was negligent. And I guess when the paramedics came, the group members were standing around the guy that was on the table who couldn't breathe. And
oh my goodness. Yeah. Okay.
And so many educated people in the room, and she would not let any of them give him CPR or help him out.
Well, okay. So she lost her license in the 70s.
Yes.
But she carried on.
I would say the late 70s, and she carried on until, I think it died in 89.
Okay. What was life like immediately after leaving the movement?
Confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to figure out the world. And I made some huge blunders. I told some of my college friends about where I had come from and what my life was. And I realized that it's too much information to give people.
Okay.
I think when you leave a cult, you have to be really careful on how much information you share.
Here, I'm just going to read what Wikipedia has to say about Betty Eisner, because okay. I feel as though it's written by somebody that really admired Betty. It paints her in a very good light. So it says that Betty Grover Eisner was born September 29th, 1915, and she passed July 1st, 2004. She was an American psychologist known for pioneering the use of LSD and other psychedelic drugs as adjuncts to psychotherapy. It says here that Eisner's accomplishments are considerable, even if one does not consider how few independent women scientists there were in the 1950s and 60s. She conducted early research into the use of LSD to treat alcoholism and maintained an active interest in hallucinogens throughout her career. Along with Sidney Cohen, Eisner appears to have originated the practice of using simultaneous male and female therapists or researchers during human hallucinogen administration. So that sounds to me like somebody's, it says nothing here about her losing her license, nothing about the communes, nothing about any of those things. It mentions a couple of books that she's written. One's titled The Unused Potential of Marriage and Sex, which was established in 1970. But it does talk about how she helped found the School for Learning, which taught English in Mexico.
Yes.
So, I mean, it talks here a lot about Betty Eisner's accomplishments within the medical field. How would people find out more information about the community that you were living in if they wanted to? Is there any publication?
I don't think much is written about it, and that's why I'm sharing my part of the story about it. And she did accomplish a lot for a woman in that time frame. But the way I see it, our group was an experiment, and I feel like we were the lab rats. And I feel like it was an experiment gone wrong.
Okay.
You know, it broke up a lot of families. It hurt a lot of people. No one ever achieved full potential. How can that be in 30 years? No one ever graduated. So.
Oh, was there actually a graduation system in place?
No, but you would think that somebody would have, you know, like, moved on to the next level. I don't think therapists keep all their patients forever, right?
I see what you mean. Yep, yep.
You know, at some point you have to say, you know what? You've done well. You've done the work. You have the tools now. Now go out and live your life. You're an incredible human being and you have so much to offer the world. Go live your life. That never happened.
I've gone through all my talking points here, so I just wanted to offer you the opportunity now to talk about anything that you think we haven't covered or any other points you'd like to go over, really.
I feel like, let's say I wrote a few things.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say to people, like, being in a cult, that it survivors of cults, you get confused of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you're born into a cult, because then you never really get to define yourself.
Okay.
You are, I suppose when you're born into a family, your family kind of helps mold who you are. But when you are molded by a narcissist, then I feel like it's a whole different kind of experience. And that that people should know, survivors should know that the cult doesn't define you. And it's your life and you survived something horrific. And that was highly manipulative. And I would have to say, my guess is all cult leaders are narcissists.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all realizing that everything that you experienced was about feeding their ego. And it really wasn't about helping the individual. And I think that survivors ought to be proud of themselves for getting out.
Absolutely.
And cautious, because statistically, survivors have a tendency to fall back into other cults. Because... Okay. So statistically, cult survivors tend to end up in cults again. And I think that's because there's something very seductive about being in a cult. And that is because you are part of a community. And that community believes that you have all the answers, that you are ahead of the curve, that you are years ahead of everybody else. I know that that's what we believed, that we were basically chosen. And mm-hmm. that's kind of cool to be a part of that.
It's definitely a common theme again with cults as well. The holier than thou, I always compare it to.
Right. Yeah. And it takes a while to find who you are. I mean, I never married because nobody ever got me, and they weren't doing it correctly, because some of my beliefs are so deep inside mm-hmm. me. Within me, that I think that the way I know how to do it is a good way, is the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so in finding this therapy that I just found this year and a half, it's only been a year and a half that I found a therapist that told me that I had experienced trauma and PTSD, which I was shocked, to be quite honest. I thought I knew more therapy than most therapists.
Mm-hmm.
And it's helped a lot in dealing with the trauma, identifying the trauma and PTSD, and doing particular modes of therapy that I didn't know about before, like EMDR. Have you ever heard of EMDR?
I haven't, no.
It's a great method of therapy where they help rewire your brain.
Okay.
To get rid of those triggers. Because okay. There's so many. Oh my God, like, music trigger.
Like tacos.
Taco salad. Timers. I can't stand a timer. Because we had to eat our meals within, what did we get? I think we got 3 or 5 minutes to eat our meal. And if we didn't finish, that was just for breakfast. But if we didn't finish in that time, it went into the blender and then you had to drink it all. So that would be oatmeal, grapefruit juice, and milk. And then, of course, we would line up to throw that up. And that was just with that one crazy lady that I lived with. I mean, the stories I could tell about that lady.
Did you apply the word cult to this movement after you left, or was that something the therapist helped you to realize?
No, and when I was in high school, I told my parents it was a cult. I go, you know this cult? And they're like, no, it isn't. Well, yeah, it is.
Do you remember having that realization?
Yeah, it was. I just remember, like, knowing that we were all following Betty. And I honestly believe that Betty was like a god, because we did not believe in religion. Religion was negative. And I believe that she was like a god. And then I remember us having a conversation one time with some of the members that Betty would never die. And some people are like, that's ridiculous. She has to die. She's a human. And it was like, how can we go on if she dies? Like, that's freaking crazy. And I do remember thinking, how is it that we're so special? If there's only like 60 of us and the whole rest of the world is crazy, that just doesn't make sense. That was illogical to me. So that was...
Did you ever try and have those conversations with people?
No.
No.
I ended up having a friend in the cult. She and I realized that if we stuck together, she's like a year and a half younger than I am, but she was, she passed away. And I think it affected her because she was like perfect. And the lady that I lived with just loved her. She did everything right and I did everything wrong, you know? And she was Black. And I thought, if only I was Black, maybe I wouldn't be such a shit and maybe I wouldn't be in trouble all the time.
Did you two stay in touch after you moved on?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She's like, she was my sister. And
you love your sisters.
Yeah. And she knew me better than my sisters know me now. I mean, she's like the closest. Anyway, she's at peace now.
What I find really interesting here is how religion, I'm guessing religion was sort of a no-no because Betty was a woman practicing science and medicine.
Mm-hmm.
But she was interested in people's past lives.
Yeah.
So that's strange, isn't it?
Yeah. She was really big into past lives. In fact, that's how that guy died, is because she thought that he had too many past lives coming through at the same time. It's in that book I'm telling you about.
Yes, which So have you read the book?
Yes.
Okay, talk us through the name of the book and what it's called. So if anybody did want to go and read a little bit more, this is probably the only thing we've come across that actually has something written about the experiments that were taking place.
Right, and it's all about the trial. It's right. Really about the trial. But in people's depositions on both sides, you get a clear picture of the group. And you can see, like, all the ones that are going for Betty, oh my God, the lies, of which is shocking to me because we were never allowed to lie. So the lies that she tells and that these other people tell in their deposition. So you can tell who's lying because they're pro Betty. The other one, and they left after the guy died because they were like, and they were called the splinter group, and they were completely ostracized, and we talked.
They were called splinters because they left.
Right.
Because in Synanon, they're called splitters if they leave.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Or splitties. I get confused between Synanon and Seedu now because they're so the same thing. So you've got a group of splinters and they're the ones in the book. What is the title of the book? Sorry.
I think it's called Deadly Blessings.
Okay.
And you could Google it. And it is three chapters. And the guy that writes it, he investigates three different cults. And I think deaths. I didn't read their parts.
But the third chapter is all about Betty and her trials.
Right. Uh-huh. And like she says that she didn't split up families. She didn't split kids up from their families in that. And which really pisses me off. Because
yeah, she's kind of confident that none of you are going to come forward and say, well, actually.
And you know what's really crazy? During the trials, I was in high school, me and my sister, who's not really my sister, she and I were in high school with the daughter of the prosecuting attorney of that case.
Right.
And she came to us at school and she said, if you want us to, he will nail Betty. You just give the word. And we're like, we have this deep conversation. We hate the group at this point, right?
And you're finally in a position of power.
Right. But our parents love it. So for our parents' sake, we didn't. Mm-hmm. We didn't nail her. We didn't give the go-ahead. And she probably would have done prison time because she didn't do any prison time for right. This guy.
She just lost her license.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we just didn't want to traumatize our parents. I was going to tell you about the same sex, the group sex.
Oh, yes. Right? Yeah.
Okay, so she also orchestrated some same-sex relationships.
Okay.
And one of them was she was one of the girls that was my sister's age. Mm-hmm. And she had to sleep with the woman that was terrorizing me, who was, you know, she was a grown woman. So we have a high school student sleeping with this grown woman. And so she had them sleep together.
Okay, so does one of the participants go to Betty and request this? Or does Betty just look at the two of them and think you'd be nice together?
Oh, yeah, she would match them up.
Right, okay. And that's probably just to reinforce the fact that has the power to do that, or just maintain. I don't know why she would do that.
I don't either. And like my sister was hooked up with this one. I mean, all of us were hooked up with somebody that we weren't attracted to.
And okay. And were either of these participants lesbians that you know of?
No. No. Well, the one in high school now is a lesbian.
Okay. Okay.
But she, you know, she was in high school. So
I probably wasn't even sure. Yeah.
Right. And then when I was in high school, she told me to hook up with one of my friends at school, have a lesbian relationship with somebody at school.
Right.
And I was like,
oh, Betty, huh? Betty told you to do this?
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
And I was like, well, ew. First of all, I was like, ew, and how do I do that? So then I asked my friend at school. Mm-hmm. I said, listen, this is what I have to do. Will you pretend that we did it?
Mm-hmm.
And so she was like, yeah, yeah, I'll help you out with that. I'll pretend. And so we knew that Betty then would probably want to talk to us about it, because you always had to have with her after you had this sexual experience. And then you would have to tell Betty all about the sex.
Right.
And my friend was like, oh, I don't think this is a good idea, because we're both virgins, so we won't even know how to make up a story. We won't even know what to say, and mm-hmm. she'll know that we're fine. And my friend was terrified of Betty.
Mm-hmm. Oh, was so, your friend, was she the daughter of another family involved in the cause? She was outside of the movement.
She was outside.
And even she knew who she was and was not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what did you do then? Did you just decline, or what happened?
Well, thank God Betty never asked me about it. So it just, she must have forgotten about
it. Okay.
You know, but she was like really big on, when my brother and I were living in Saudi Arabia, she wrote me a letter. Betty wrote me a letter, and of which I was so proud, like, oh my God, I'm so special now. And then Betty's grace is, you know, she's writing me. And she, in the letter, she told me, now it's time for your brother to start masturbating. You need to tell your brother that.
And like, then people really wonder why you overshare when you're telling them about this cult that you were involved in. How can you not, when that's what you've grown up with?
Right. Like, you don't know you don't know boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
What do you think about cults that are similar to this one in the way that they're set up with the communities and stuff? How do you think that this COVID-19 virus has been affecting those types of movements?
I would be terrified.
Do you reckon it's damaging cults, or do you think it's helping them thrive because everybody has to stay sort of where they are and there's no traveling about and stuff?
I would imagine that it's thriving, but I would imagine that people, the ones that are being terrorized within them, that it's more so. However, where are they going to go now?
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to find a community outside of their cult?
It's just something that every time I do one of these episodes at the moment, and places reopen and then they close again, and I keep thinking to myself, I wonder if there's any off-grid cults that are thriving because they don't need everything to be open. They don't, you know, being in lockdown is not really anything new to them. But then I've been reading about some Jehovah's Witnesses that have resorted to putting letters through people's post boxes to ask for donations, because usually they would go and do the door-to-door stuff. So I guess some movements are flourishing and some are struggling.
Well, yeah, that's true. And all these ones that I've heard about that are out on the streets trying to sell, like, t-shirts, and they're selling stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard some of your podcasts about, you know, that they have to go out and they have to work really hard to
make
money. And yeah, if that's their source of income is depending on the outside world, you know, they're stuck. They're in a, but they can all apply for unemployment, can't they?
That's
so
true.
Then they pull their resources together and maybe they live under one roof.
Maybe. Hopefully we're not giving people too many ideas here.
Yeah, right. I'm not. I'm gonna edit that.
Edit that out. Take that bit out.
I think that there was a way to, like, to help people see. Like, I know somebody who's in a cult right now. Well, her husband's in a cult.
Okay.
And she's really struggling in the relationship to be in it or to not be in it. And I'm like, dude, like, he's in a cult. He's going to bring you into it. Mm-hmm. You aren't a believer right now, but the only way for this relationship to work is for you to leave him. But she doesn't understand what a dark hole that is. How can you if you've never been in one? Because you believe, like, I'm not going to fall for all that. I know who I am. But it is so seductive. They slowly manipulate you and bring you in. You know, they're so kind to you in the beginning and empower you. And then that's when they start doing the manipulation so that you feel as though you're dependent on them mm-hmm. and that they have all the answers.
And you just wait for the answers and wait and wait.
Yeah. And yeah.
Well, hopefully your friend can sit down and have a conversation with you and realize the seriousness of what, you know, what potentially could happen if her husband is involved in something that's as sinister as a cult.
How did you get into this?
Oh, well, I've wanted to start a podcast for ages, and I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts. And then I was off on maternity leave and then lockdown started. So I just decided to sit down and start putting some podcast material together. And my friend recommended looking into cults. And at first I thought it was just going to be sort of half an hour episodes of the really infamous, like, ones that you see on Netflix, you know, cults that you hear about all over the news. But actually I found it much more interesting and empowering for other people as well to talk about the lesser known cults that have actually affected people and give them a platform to speak. And my episodes have gone from only being half an hour to being sort of 2 hours long. But yeah, I'm just really enjoying hearing people's stories, and, you know, people get in touch and they say, you know, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity because I haven't had it before. And that for me is, you know, that's great to hear. That's awesome. So hopefully something will come of it, and I can just carry on doing it and carry on speaking to people like yourself and gathering all these stories and just putting them on the internet.
That's cool. Because it's a blessing for people like us to have some play and to hear other people's stories, because then you don't feel like you're so alone in the world, because we are a small minority, you know, and it's, and one thing that I keep looking for is, like, it feels like everybody, all the cults that I've listened to, the kids got to stay with their parents within mm-hmm. the cult. And I haven't yet found a story where, except for the CDs when they got sent away to
school. I think Synanon as well, they sent all the kids to the hatchery, and then that was the name of, like, the, all the kids went to the same place, and if you spent too much time going to see your child, then you were, you know, you were shamed.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
It's always with the shaming, isn't it? So, yeah, parents were sort of encouraged not to go and visit their children. So maybe it's Santa Monica.
You're right.
I really do wonder if Betty and Charles Dederick ever sat down with each other and discussed what they could do in their respected movements because they're so similar.
Do you want to hear something crazy?
Yes.
I lived in the apartment that faced Synanon for, I lived in that apartment for 12 years.
Really?
After I went to New York and I came back, yeah.
The main building.
The big brick building.
The old National Guard building?
I don't know. It could have been a National Guard building. It's beautiful.
It is.
It's a beautiful building. Oh, yeah. And my living room looked right out on it. And then right beyond that, you see the Santa Monica Pier.
Was it still running at the time you lived there?
No. It's Casa del Mar now, which is a big fancy.
Oh, right. Yeah, I know which building you mean. Yeah.
And it was, Pritikin? I think it was a fat farm. I think it was Pritikin.
I have absolutely no idea.
After Synanon, yeah.
So how long did your dad stay with Synanon?
I think he only did the one of those power weekends.
And then he came back?
Yeah, and then he was able to come back. Yeah. Yep.
What did your parents do after everything finished?
My dad stayed with that woman.
Okay.
They got married. And they kind of lived a normal life, I guess. And then my mom, she left before my father did.
Right.
And she opened a massage school. And so she got into that and she kind of was floundering. She's kind of trying to find herself. And so she was hanging out with a Brazilian group for a while. And then she ended up going back to Catholicism.
Okay.
That's her root. And Betty used to just dig on her, shame her for being a Catholic. And, you know, Catholics have all their stuff anyway. So my poor mother.
Do you think she managed to find some peace when she went back to Catholicism?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
And your siblings now, have they found any kind of peace at all?
I feel like it. Yeah. My one sister's living in England with her husband. And his family is just so lovely. I just love them. So I'm so happy for her because she has a nana now that just like embraces her. And she's wonderful. And she's got a couple of kids. And then my brother has gone, he just went back east and he's a Bostonian type and he's very New England. And very traditional family, and I don't think his kids know much about his history, or they don't really know us, and then his wife thinks that we're bat crazy. But, you know, he's happy, and he is putting 100%, I mean, his life is all about his daughters. So he's done the complete opposite, and, you know, good on him for that. And then my oldest sister, she's married also, and she has two stepkids that they're kind of doing their own little thing, but her husband's wonderful and she's, you know, loving her life. And I'm in California just finishing up my career. I have a partner now for, oh gosh, we're going on 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
I had a very confusing time because of all the sexual stuff in the group, I really struggled with my sexuality. I had zero clue who I was. Then I had zero clue who to be with. So I went through a whole time of trying to figure out if I was gay or straight or what I was. And so I've settled. I've been with this woman who is very patient with me and my triggers and, you know, just trying to understand, you know, and be present and, you know, figure out how to be in a relationship.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's just somebody with a little bit of patience is often all that's needed, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, because I hadn't been really attached to anything, I think, when I was a kid. So I just was so used to, oh, just leave.
Disassociate yourself.
Right. So now I'm sticking in there, and we have two dogs.
You have two dogs, and you're living back where it all started.
Yeah, not quite. I'm not in Santa Monica anymore. Yeah. But I am back in California, and I a big part of me wants to leave California. Now that I'm done with my career, I'd like to go someplace else.
So we'll are you going to be retiring?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
August 29th.
Do you have plans for when you retire?
Yeah. Oh, you want to hear my plans?
Yes. Yes, please.
I'm going to England. I'm going to live for 6 months in Spain and Portugal. Oh, then COVID hit. So
yes. Yeah.
There go the plans. So I don't know what's going to happen.
Oh, well, you'll have all the time you need to go anywhere you want in the world when it's all, you know, hopefully back to normal. Yeah. However long that takes.
I know, right? So now I'm doing pottery.
Oh, you're doing pottery? Oh, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Is that a new hobby, or is it something?
No, it's quite new. I yeah.
And you do that from your home?
Now I am, yeah. I was going to a studio and taking classes, but now with COVID.
Yeah.
So I'm in my garage with it.
Oh, that's so wonderful, though, to have a hobby that you can do from home.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
it does help. It helps with just the hours in the day. Sort of, what would I do with myself today? Oh, I can go into my garage and I can do some pottery. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just one last question from me before we finish. You've spoken about going to therapy to help you work through some of the stuff and trauma that you were exposed to when you were a kid. Do you recommend therapy for other cult survivors?
I do. Because you have to figure out how to rewire everything. And I think that your reality was, I can't imagine anybody coming out of a cult where their reality wasn't fucked with. But I have to say, my siblings have not taken the path of therapy the way I have.
Okay.
You know, and they're thriving, they're doing fine. So it's not a must, but I personally think it's helpful.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Tori, for taking the time to sit down and speak with me today. I really hope that what we've touched upon and covered today will help some people somewhere with their experiences, or even just raise red flags when joining a new yoga group or a new craft group, or you know, the way that we often hear these things popping up in this day and age. I really hope that you continue to find peace with everything and you continue to heal through your therapy. And I really hope that my book arrives soon so that I can read the chapter all about Betty Eisner.
Yeah, I hope so too. And yeah, if you have any further questions, please don't hesitate.
Thank you so much, Tori, for your time today. I really, really appreciate you sitting down and talking with me.
Thank you. This is really a pleasure. And thank you for all the work that you're doing.
Oh, it's no, that is fantastic. That is my pleasure. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day, Tori, and goodbye to your two dogs as well.
Okay, bye-bye.
You congratulations,
baby.
Thank you so much, Tori. Bye, thank you.